Good morning, everybody in the audience, for joining us. Thanks for being here. And it's a great pleasure to have today with us on Antoine de Saint-Affrique, the CEO of Danone, the very new, I mean, exactly 1 year new CEO, I think. Thanks, Antoine, for joining us today.
Pleasure.
So for the audience, I don't know if you've gotten used to the fireside, to the pigeonhole thing. You should have on your floor plan, a little booklet you have and things, a QR code, which you can scan to ask questions during the sessions. The latter part of the session, I'll be sort of going through them here on my screen. So please, if you can, scan if you want to ask question. It makes it a lot easier for us to get all the questions together. Now, back to you, Antoine, with that out of the way. ESG, let's start straight going in there. You've clearly been on the forefront of it historically. You know, I'm thinking about Entreprise Mission, B Corp, and all of that. But there is a bit of a backlash against ESG, to at least certain forms of it, and also a realization that it can backfire. I mean, just think about Ben & Jerry's at Unilever being just one recent example. You also, in your root causing at the Capital Markets Day, you did identify issues historically with ESG execution. I think you called it disconnected purpose, saying that historically there was insufficient contribution from purpose to value creation at Danone. And I really would like you to elaborate a little bit deeper on that, and also for the broader audience, you know, what did you learn about ESG, whether it either goes too far, doesn't really deliver what you want? Can you elaborate on that and sort of tell us more about how to think about other companies as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I think about ESG, and I think the way, by the way, the company thinks about ESG, and that was in the roots of Danone, is performance and sustainability go hand in hand. I mean, performance without sustainability very clearly has no future. I mean, we know it every more, we know it every day, we see it every day a little more. But sustainability without performance has no impact. So it's not one or the other, it's the two together. And so the name of the game for us, and that's why I said we need to relink sustainability and performance, is to really look at sustainability not only as a moral imperative, which it is as well, but as a key strategic stake and as a key feature for performance. If your entire business model is geared on health through food, and therefore depends on foods, making sure that there is a vibrant agriculture, that there is a vibrant nature, that our farmers are making a living, is obviously a matter of sustainability, but it's fundamentally a matter of our performance for your company. Making sure that what you sell, the way you sell it, is socially and environmentally acceptable when you are in consumer goods is not only something that has to do with sustainability, but has fundamentally to do with the longer-term performance of your business. So if you look 5 years out, I mean, sustainability is as much a strategic imperative, but you need to make sure that it's focused and linked to the heart of your business. And therefore, you focus on where you have either a disproportionate responsibility or a disproportionate impact, and you treat it as a strategic stake. The minute you're capable of doing it faster and better than the rest of the competition, number one, you create a competitive advantage. Number two, you force the rest of the industry to align on yourself. So back to the start of your question and what I was saying, it's not sustainability for the sake of it, or even if sustainability is extremely important. It is sustainability for a purpose to make the business better, but also as a business having more impact.
Now, the way you describe sustainability there is quite a self-interested sustainability, because you do it, you know, because you can't be successful commercially if you're not sustainable. But then in some of your activities, I struggle with the self-interested element of your activity. So I think about B Corp. I think about Entreprise Mission, and when I read the documents about B Corp and all of that, it really goes above and beyond about making society a better place, dealing with income inequality, you know, a vast variety of issues. And so why, I can I'm personally totally convinced about the self-interested sustainability point of view, but why go above and beyond that? Why, I mean, isn't a B Corp half a charitable kind of ambition? Because then you have to reallocate the resources of your own company, not just sustainability, but to achieve other societal goals.
I think the reality of B Corp or Société à Mission, for that matter, I mean, there is actually an alignment between the self-interest and the moral imperative. It is a flag. It is a fantastic way to attract people. It is a fantastic way to differentiate yourself from the company. It is a great way to measure yourself as well. So it's not either or, again, it's not either self-interest or impact. It's both at the same time converging and overlapping there.
But at which point, sorry to keep pushing on that because I know you want ideally both, but B Corp goes above beyond that, right? It's too good without necessarily self-beneficial. Thinking about Ben and Jerry's and trying to solve peace in Palestine as a problem, they think like, is that a self-interested move? So at which point do you feel does ESG need to come up with how much self-interest does it need to be before you decide to tackle an issue as a B Corp?
We cannot, and that's probably a bigger debate, we shouldn't, and that's probably one of the unique features of Danone, oppose sustainability and performance and put them into different worlds. And proving that you can have both and that actually sustainability is contributing to your performance is something that is unique with Danone, is something which I think, by the way, is the future of companies. Once again, if there is no farmers, if there is no farmland, if there is no rain, there won't be food for the people. So there is a global responsibility and there is a moral imperative. But there is also an economic self-interest, and it's the two at the same time. It's not one or the other, and it's not one opposed to the other. I think one of the very unique features of Danone is being able, and that was the case in the past, and hopefully it will be the case in the future, being able to prove that one is not opposed to that and that it's not about a trade-off, but actually one can feed the other and can feed the other from an economic standpoint. If you are better than anybody else at tackling regenerative agriculture, if you are better than anybody else at tackling the packaging challenges, you do good for the planet, but you also create a competitive advantage. And by the way, as creating a competitive advantage, you do good for the planet because people will align to you. The other thing is you attract better talent. And I think the passion of the Danoners and the commitment of the Danoners, including in the crisis we went through, is a great example of that.
Yeah. So maybe back to the words of disconnected purpose, which is what you initially wrote. So purpose, but it has to have a connection ultimately to where you want to go.
Yeah, because you want purpose and impact. It goes back to performance without sustainability has no future, in my view, clearly, and every day is proving that. But sustainability without performance has very limited impact.
Yeah. So think about the drivers between ESG. Historically, people have thought the board, the company, the family was strongly behind that. There was quite a big, surprising, and rapid move to replace the entire board of Danone and sort of senior leadership. Can you just tell a little bit the importance of that and the role that that kind of whole change at governance, you know, how that's part of this and what role that's playing for you at Danone?
Well, as you know, there was a major and very public governance crisis in Danone with a publicly very, very divided board. I think the board made an extremely courageous decision and one that was in the interest of the company, which was to decide to renew itself entirely over a period of about 18 months. What you've seen is the first wave of renewal. which profiles of people that are people with broad international experience, with real credentials in the field of business and for some in the field of business and sustainability. And I mean, you could expect as we renew the second half of the board that you have the same quality. And we will get, and we are already into a place where the board is a real sparring partner on everything, and is looking at the way we allocate capital, the way we allocate our resource, through the lens of how do we create our value in a way that is sustainable over the long run.
Now, you're in a turnaround situation, and when investors talk with me, I say, look, it can only work, the Danone turnaround, if you can make yogurt exciting again. And clearly,
I find it, by the way, very exciting. I'll tell you.
So do I, but it's not showing in sales numbers just yet, Antoine. And then the question is obviously, where is the potential for excitement in yogurt? And when I look here in the UK and I look at Nielsen data, it's quite obvious that premium yogurt sells faster. I mean, we see premium doing better in many, many categories, whether it's coffee, chocolate, and many other parts. Now, your presence in premium isn't very strong, in my view, but look at your price point. Oikos is getting a little bit in there, but seems to be better positioned. Do you really have, A, do you agree that premiumization will be an essential part, and B, do you really think your current brands have the brand equity to be players on the premium end of yogurt?
So, I mean, the answer is yes, but let me elaborate on that. I mean, the first thing is, if you look at the U.S., which is probably a good example of where we should be going, actually the entire our entire yogurt portfolio is doing extremely well, both in terms of growth, in terms of market share, with the right mix, by the way, of our premiumization in some cases, but also making sure that the things that are less premium remain extraordinarily relevant. So it's not only a game of premiumization, it's also a game of differentiation at every price point, which in some cases is something that we have that we have forgotten. So I think the first message is we've proven it can work in the US. It is work in progress in a part of the other geographies. I think the second message is about 60% of our portfolio is highly differentiated. I mean, it is about immunity, it is about gut health. So it is with benefits, which in some places, in some instances, we need to better claim, but benefits that are clearly differentiated and clearly relevant to the consumer and drive in turn for a premium in the segment in which they they compete. The third point is, in a number of cases, we haven't done the job properly. I mean, everybody forgets that something that was a truth some years ago, which is a Danone yogurt is not a yogurt, it's a Danone. And it's a Danone because of the uniqueness of the ferments, because what the ferments do in terms of releasing all the power and all the goodness of what's in the milk, and it makes a difference. And by the way, it makes a difference at an affordable price point. When I was a kid, like most of the French kids, you'd be given a Danone, number one, because it would help calcium, number two, because whenever you were sick, it would help restore internal flora. We forgot claiming the goodness of even our more basic products to make sure that at every price point they are differentiated, which is a job that we are restarting to do, and we do it better in some places and not yet in some others. But that's the direction of travel. And still, by the way, doing very well with innovation and very premium products in yogurt, like what we do with HiPro or YoPro, like what we do with Actimel, and in some countries, Activia is good in some, not so good in others.
And Oikos, it looks a bit more premium in the US than over here. Are you aiming that to be part of the kind of more premium brands, or?
Everything that is around proteins is a fantastic trend. And there we have been a pioneer. I mean, we had virtually no business 3 years ago. It's a business that is more than 400 million today. extremely differentiated, premium, and fast-growing. And there, it's back in some ways to the basics of consumer goods. I mean, first thing is there is a protein trend with younger people that want to build up their muscles, with people my age that want to slow down the decay of their muscle. Number two, the offering on the market was not satisfactory. You buy big pouches of whey that taste horrible. So you take a trend, you execute it in a way that is easy to take and extremely pleasant. And I encourage you to taste the product if you haven't, so they are extremely pleasant, and executed in a totally differentiated way. Black packaging, cutting on shelf, with formats that are thought for people that are on the go. And guess what? I mean, then you tap into the trend and you create something that is a real marketing, both for economical success.
So you've mentioned the protein space. We've talked about the premiumization. Any other subsegments of yogurt that you think are, you know, particularly rich for higher growth?
Well, immunity is, and we've seen that with Actimel, is something that is extremely relevant, and where there are still plenty of ways to go. Gut health in different forms, by the way, which is can be transit, which was Actizor, can be the balance of your internal flora, or can be digestion, is something that is extremely relevant as well. But at the other end of the spectrum, and we shouldn't forget that, I mean, pleasure is part of health. If I don't have a Danette in my fridge, I've got a riot at home. So making sure that you also address segments that are fundamental needs of people, even more so in crisis time, and you do it in a way that offers the best experience at the right value is as fundamental and as differentiating, by the way, as offering health benefits.
Part of your strategy was very much about investing in A&P, which you sort of criticized the rundown previously, and in innovation. Any highlights of, like, in A&P, has that started? Because you rightly say Europe is not growing as fast as the U.S. Is that A&P landing? Where can we see that increased A&P spend today, where you most need it?
Yeah, so you, I mean, you have seen in the H1 result, we started spending in absolute money a little more, but it's not only, and we'll keep spending more, by the way, moving forward, and we've said it. But it's not only spending more, even spending more is absolutely needed. It's also spending better. So making sure that the balance between our working media and our non-working media is in a different space than today, which goes hand in hand, by the way, with stopping the proliferation of subscale innovation. So that at least you have less things, you support them for longer, and by the way, you use your copies for better. It's also about making choices on where to invest. In countries where, or on some mixes, where we are clearly underperforming, so things that are in the 25% we showed as underperforming, there, we, in some cases, need to fix the performance or the basics of the performance before putting money. So you move money from left to right in a much more intentional way. So more money for sure, but also money better spent with clear choice.
But on a scale of like 100%, how far are you in the A&P spend, or how many years will it take to get to the level where you want to be? Are you at 20% of the ramp-up you want to do, 50?
Well, I think it will take us the duration of the guidance, so the 3 years of the 3 years of the guidance, and I wouldn't phase it, and I wouldn't phase it for obvious reasons, which is you need to adapt to also the circumstances of the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've stopped investing in Russia. We had that discussion in January. I would have a different view, but the direction of travel is very clear, and the magnitude of commitment is very clear as well.
And similarly on innovation, where I presume it might be a longer lead time before you get the innovations you want, can you pinpoint examples of where innovation, since your new plan, is starting to turn performance?
Yeah. Well, I regret to see the wrong brand on the table, but Evian Sparkling, which you can find now in a number of restaurants in the U.K. I mean, it seems obvious. It's very difficult, by the way, to do an Evian Sparkling with the taste of Evian. It suddenly opens you a whole new world of premium restaurants and premium waters. So there are things that you can do in the short term. There are things also that will require longer investment and longer term. I think one of the most important thing that we made besides reinvesting in R&D is change the structure of the company by appointing a head of R&D at the executive committee, which is the first time, I think, in the history of the company, with a very, very clear mandate, which is to build not only the short term, but also the longer term innovation pipeline, to tap into the unique pockets that we have. I mean, we have a knowledge in the field of, pre and probiotics that is incredible. We have a knowledge in the field of gut health that is incredible. We have a bank of ferments that is incredible. Few people realize, well, all of you know, but few people realize that with what we do in medical nutrition, either helping oncology recovery or addressing metabolics, there is a depth of knowledge that is extraordinary. The name of the game is how do you leverage it across? How do you also plan for the next stage in a way that is much more systematic? And how do we make sure that we move from a flurry of very tactical innovation to the right mix between some tactical innovation, because you'll still need tactical innovations, but much more structuring innovation, the likes of what we are doing with our proteins?
Now, one conundrum on Danone for me has always been that in the U.S., your performance is strong, holding up against private label, different price points, but Europe has been much poorer. And this doesn't seem to be just a lower growth economy. Your relative performance doesn't seem to be as good. Surely the European colleagues have seen the performance in the U.S. for quite a few years. What is holding them back? Why does it take, so what explains that performance level difference in Europe versus the U.S.? And it's not a new issue. What is holding back a kind of a catch-up between the regions?
Well, first thing is, I think over the last 2 years, the U.S. have done a very, very good job. I mean, they were ahead of the curve in bringing the entire company together. And so moving from being very focused on restructuring an organization and back into the market. So there is a phasing dimension. Let's not forget that Europe, I mean, the company in general, but Europe in particular, has been in permanent restructuring for a long time. The last one, which was the biggest one from a magnitude standpoint, taking place last January. So you need to refocus people on the market from where they were, which is which organization do I belong, what are my reporting lines, and all the rest of it. That's the first dimension. The second dimension is Europe is not Europe. You have very different degrees of performance in different parts of Europe. And it's a mix of heritage. It's a mix of quality of management in some cases, or of absence of continuity and focus. So there is not one response to Europe. You have parts of Europe, and if I'm looking at my Polish business, I mean, what a great business. The business here in the UK, actually, is a pretty... is a pretty strong business. You've heard me say very publicly, so it won't be a surprise to anyone, that we structurally underperformed in Spain, where we had, by the way, a huge rotation of management, also organization, over the last numbers of years. So you're absolutely right. We have underperformed in large parts of Europe, and it shows on... It shows on average, Europe is late versus the U.S. in terms of stability, but the direction of travel is very clear there.
Now, from a macroeconomic point of view, everybody is worried about down trading. Quarter one and quarter two, everybody relieved how good the price elasticities were, including in Danone. Looking at the last few months of Nielsen data, private label is making more inroads, particularly in the Danone categories, especially in Europe, but even the U.S. has started to change. Do you see, you know, how do you think about down trading? You know, do you recognize, first of all, those patterns we see in Nielsen? And also, how will you respond to those? Is it all about keeping market share and rolling back your price increases? And the obvious knock-on, could that delay sort of your margin commitments you've done for the year? I know there's a lot in there, but...
Yeah, the, I mean, the first thing is you don't see something uniform. So you see a relatively low price elasticity in the U.S. You see some price elasticity, huge price elasticity in places like Russia, and you see very different patterns in Europe, and those patterns are a mix of things. It's a mix of the strengths of your brand and therefore how differentiated is your brand, and also the mix of channels and the strength of such type of retailers. So the picture, you cannot even average the picture at your open level, or you need to look one step down. On to Nielsen, I would go to the same place, which is look one step down. In some places, you see either discounters or taking Spain, as I was talking, Spain, Mercadona doing very well, but outside Mercadona, you don't see so much more elasticity. In some places, and Nielsen doesn't capture it directly, but it shows as a non-direct, you have conflict with our distributors, so you're out of shelves for a couple of weeks. So obviously, you see private labels or other players going up. Is it elasticity? Probably not. It's just your presence in the shelf. So I would just take, I mean, the answer is there is no one answer. It's really country by country. And I would take their Nielsen with a pinch of salt, because you need to go one or two levels down to analyze. Then the question is how do you get at this? You don't translate inflation only into price. I mean, you really work into, I mean, on the full keyboard. You obviously work on your productivity. You obviously work SKU by SKU on all the options you have at your disposal. So you do really revenue growth management. There are some SKUs that were structurally underpriced, or where you have the muscles and where you have the consumer relevance. You might play the price higher. There are some SKUs that are less strong, either because they are less differentiated or less relevant, you get them, you increase them less. You play on the degree of promotion next to the degree of price. So you play in a very, very sophisticated way at a very, very, at a very, very granular level. The other thing you do, and in some ways the crisis is good to that extent, is it is one more opportunity to simplify. So making sure that you do less innovation of better quality, making sure that your weaker SKUs you cut, making sure also that you look at what you offer to the consumer, and you double down on what is relevant, but you trim out what is not relevant. So I mean, we have a great example in Germany, where we've realized that the plastic add-on that you put on the top of the big pot of yogurt, I mean, it has been there for historical reasons, nobody has questioned, brings zero value. The consumer doesn't need it. Actually, consumer thinks that, back to the very first question, it's not sustainable. So you get the end in end. You remove it. I mean, you do productivity. You can preserve your margin. It's better for the... It is better for the consumer. So there are many ways of tackling the problem.
But if I summarize the beginning part of your answer, you don't see any material change yet in what everybody has reported at quarter one and quarter two of good resilience?
We see, as I said, we see different resilience in different countries, but the trends we had seen in at the end of the first quarter, so 2 months ago or 1 month ago, are more or less the same. Yes.
More or less the same. Now, beyond down trading, the other big question obviously is commodity prices and their increases.
well published which ones are going down and which ones don't go down. Now you have one particular commodity, dairy,
yep,
which is very different from many other ones. It has a longer life cycle because cows need feedstock and feedstock depends on fertilizer. So there's a kind of a thought out there that the, well, most of the commodities are coming down. Dairy could be in for a much longer cycle of pain because of the time it takes for this cost to feed through. Do you recognize that? Do you see indeed a longer curve of dairy inflation or not?
Well, there is obviously an impact of the current crisis on dairy. And this is where, by the way, what you do from a sustainability standpoint also makes a difference. I mean, if you're engaged into our long-term contracts with your farmers, you guarantee a different security of supply. Obviously, translate it into the price, but you have the availability and you have the consistency of your supply. If you're good at managing the various components of the milk, because you're treating lots of milk, you manage some of the dimensions of it. I was actually discussing, and it will seem very far away, but I'll bring it back in a minute. We have been pioneering in regenerative agriculture, and in particular in regenerative dairy farming, for obvious reason, and back to what I was saying at the very beginning. One of the things that you get out of that is by feeding the cows better, which means, by the way, in some cases less, but with better quality, you get more milk of better quality. So you progressively change the mix and the value equation for the farmers. With two impacts, you still have farmers, so you don't have people that are moving away from milk farming. And the second thing is it's more profitable for them, so there is less elasticity in terms of your impact. So sorry for that, that segue, but do we see an impact on milk price? Yes, we do. Yes, we do see it. Is everything that we are doing, or does everything that we are doing also from a sustainability have a direct impact on the way we handle? Yes, that's why, getting back to your first question, it makes also a difference.
You talked about your relationship with farmers. Yeah. Am I right that the material part is cost-plus kind of contract because you have long-term contracts with these farmers?
Yeah, so we have a mix of, I mean, we play with big players and we play with small farmers, with about 58,000, I think, small farmers. There, yes, we are in a model that is essentially cost-plus.
And the big ones is spot pricing, contract pricing, how does that work?
It depends on the big one and depends on the way we handle.
Okay, trying again. That's 58,000 farmers. Are they the half of your trade? The 58,000 that have cost plus contracts?
Well, listen. A large part of our sourcing is local sourcing and is linked to local farmers. Yes.
Okay. Now moving on to plant based, of which you have a strong position in some of it. Now, parts of plant based are losing their luster, whether it's the Beyond Meat kind of examples in the U.S. Even your own plant-based targets have come down. So to what extent do you still have the confidence that this is a major driver of growth, or does plant-based need to reinvent itself?
I think I think that we are on a very long-term consumer trend. I think the consumer trend, by the way, is not, I mean, the world is not going vegan, the world is going flexitarian. And the good news is that is we are the largest flexitarian company in the world. I mean, we play on both. And both are extremely useful, needed, taken at all stages of life. So you need more dairy protein in the form of yogurt. When you are in your young age, at some point you tend to go more plant-based. You don't use one and the other for the same, and if you go in the fridge of most people, you generally have both. So being the leader in both is a good point where to start. We do believe that plant-based will keep growing. It is obviously normalizing after COVID, also because of the balance of in-home out of home. Still growing at around mid-single digit in most geographies. The way we look at our own portfolio of plant-based is probably in three, I don't know if it's three layers or three horizons. Our plant-based was largely started as our drinks ingredient-driven. Okay? And that's where we started. That's where the market is. Their name of the game is to have the right competitiveness at the right level of profitability. So making sure that our products are better than competition, both in their taste, but also in their convenience, while delivering a profitable business model, which is important. Not everybody is capable of doing that. There is a second dimension, which is beyond being ingredient-driven. It's starting to be benefit-driven. And you've probably seen what we've done in a number of countries with not milk, which is about offering a milk alternative that is not milk. So it has the taste of milk, it has the color of milk, but it's purely out of plant-based. And there is a third dimension, which is in each of the categories where it's relevant and where we are playing, offering a plant-based alternative to something that is dairy-based, but playing by the rules of the category. So when you sell a dessert, just saying it's plant-based is not going to make it. It needs to be a superb and exciting dessert. So when you have the Alpro coconut-based, it is first a fantastic coconut dessert. It happens to be plant-based and meets the needs of the plant-based consumer, but in a way that doesn't compromise. And that's the name of the game. So we see plenty of space to grow at those three levels. We are disciplined, by the way, in doing it in a profitable way.
Where do the fermentation-based approaches sit? I know you've recently announced some, I think, activity. In a way, it seems even more sustainable. It's not really plant-based, but it has the potential to be, you know, cow-free dairy. Where do you see that to supersede plant-based, part of plant-based, an alternative? How do you think about the potential there?
Well, there are plenty of things happening actually for a number of years in everything that is either precision fermentation or controlled fermentation. I mean, my past life in cocoa, I mean, fermentation was also a big topic. There are plenty and plenty of things, which are not necessarily, by the way, about replacing this or that, but which are for a large part about releasing more out of this or that. Bringing new ingredients or new elements, bringing new benefits to the surface. The start of the story, and I'll go back to one of the founders of the company, Isaac Carasso. Isaac Carasso was a gentleman living in Barcelona. He discovered, he was from Bulgarian origin, he discovered that by fermenting milk with a specific set of ferments, he was enabling a whole kind of possibilities in terms of digestion, in terms of availability of calcium, in terms of what happened to pre and probiotics. There is still plenty of things that can be done in that field next to what you do through precision fermentation in plant-based or as milk or as dairy alternative or dairy enhancer. So it's a very rich field, which, by the way, speaks back to what I just said in terms of our research and development. That is certainly a place where we have lots of expertise, and that's a place where we'll keep pushing.
I'll soon go over to the investor questions, so please, if you want to enter your question, the QR code is there. My last question is on China. I always seem to think too good to be true, given how well it's doing, but well done there. I'm focusing on the new regulation that I think starts February next year. Everybody has to be recertified. Can you just discuss the balance in risk and opportunities? The opportunity seems obvious. You might gain market share from many small ones going out of the market. How sizable is that? But what about the associated risk that the government could use the quality cleanup of the recipes to impose maximum profits, you know, reduce pricing in China like they've done in other categories?
So listen, I'm not going to speculate on what the Chinese government may or may not do. One thing is clear is, I mean, we are progressing according to plan together with the Chinese government on certification. So far, so good. I think the important thing as well is in China, we keep driving different types of businesses. So our infant milk business is doing very well. In a market that is, as we predicted, by the way, declining. But there, it's the strength of being a Chinese-born business in some way, a digitally driven business, a business with lots of relevance because we launch our best products in China, because we have our... because we have research that is based in China. But what is important is next to that, we have also a medical nutrition business, which is growing extremely extremely nicely. And I mean, we disclosed in the CMD that our medical nutrition business accounts for about 40%, give or take, of our total SN business. Slightly less in China, but not massively different. And obviously, we are in the process of fixing Mizone, which is a very profitable brand. So it is about keeping doing the good job in our IMF, also making sure that we build our structural resilience by building our different types of businesses.
Over to the investor questions. The most popular question is on same topic. Danone's profit pool in China IMF is about 20% of group EBIT. Is a significant burden given the infant population is set to decline by almost half in the next couple of years. How do you address this?
Well, you address it in, as I just said, in a number of different ways. One is you keep driving added value in China, so you bring things that make a real difference, that are relevant to the consumer. You try to do a good job in the way you manage your distribution, and there we are pretty good. And in the value you add to the consumer, I mean, what we are doing through artificial intelligence and data, through apps that are dedicated to consumer, through our DNA testing is really impressive, and you keep building an edge in your core category. Next to that, you make sure that you have other businesses that are unprofitable and growing, which is why we keep driving our medical nutrition, which is why we're focusing on fixing Mizone. And next to that, you want to make sure that you keep growing your other businesses. IMF in Europe is growing and doing nicely. We keep expanding it into the places that are relevant. So it's not stopping one to grow the other, but it's trying to build a more structural resilience.
The next question is, Danone sales are structured toward breakfast spend. Do you need to buy or create new products to capture more daypart consumer spend?
Well, actually, it's interesting because the perception is that we are geared toward breakfast. The reality is slightly different. I mean, water has nothing to do with breakfast. Everything that is specialized nutrition has nothing to do with our breakfast. And then when you take EDP, a large part of our plant-based business is actually things that you put in your coffee, so you can take coffee for breakfast. But you do that during the day, you do that in bars, etc. Everything that is your pro, you take actually at the moment or around the sports moment. So we have a breakfast dimension, which is historically important, but it's not only breakfast, by a distance.
Having joined Danone almost exactly 12 months ago, what have been the biggest positive and negative surprises in your tenure compared to what you expected before joining?
So I think, and I said it, I think I said it very consistently. The most impressive thing I found when I come in Danone were the commitment, the resilience, and the motivation of the people. And you take a company that had been through an extraordinary public governance crisis, a company that. Where a very charismatic leader had been asked to leave, a company that was in the midst of a giant restructuring, and still you had people that were going the extra mile, people that were passionate about the company, people that really wanted to do the right thing, and that that speaks, by the way, to the purpose of Danone and to the culture of Danone. It speaks obviously to the people. And that was, I think, not fully a surprise, but really impressive. Well, I think the thing that was obviously also not totally a surprise, but was negative, and I said it at the Capital Market Day, is the disconnect between the categories that are growing. Our categories have been growing 3 to 4% per year over the last numbers of years, and a company that that wasn't. I mean, there was a disconnect between our growth and the disconnect between our growth and our category growth, and as a result, an underinvestment, or as a cause, it's a vicious circle, an underinvestment in our brands and a lack of consistency. So that's what we are trying to address with Renew Danone, which was and that's what we said actually with Renew Danone, which is it's moving from underperform to perform. It is putting back putting back some consistency in the way we execute, putting back some passion on our categories. Our categories are good categories, and deliver.
I know not everybody is using this system to put questions in. Does anybody in the audience have an urgent question they want to ask before I continue on this medium? Anybody wants to speak up in case you're not using the Pigeonhole? In which case, I'll keep doing the Pigeonhole. Now, with changes in marketing efficiencies, spending changes from network TV to more personalized direct messaging offerings. How is Danone positioned with your current spending? So what is the weighting of old versus new channels today?
So we are probably at par with the industry, but not amongst the best, would be the answer, with vastly different degrees of execution country by country. I was talking about China. China is, for us, the most advanced place from a digital media, from a retail media standpoint. Some places where we are not at the level where I want us to be. Once you've said that, we have plenty of opportunities. You talk about our first-party consumer data. When you deliver water to hundreds and thousands of people every month, which we do in places like Indonesia or Mexico, you have a huge opportunity. So part of the thing we are in the process of doing is making sure that when we are very good somewhere, we take the learning and we expand it everywhere, which is why you heard me say more than once, local first doesn't mean local only. You need to have the resilience and the speed to market in given market, but we need also to use our muscles and leverage across the company in a much more disciplined and systematic way.
So there are a few questions around inflation, which I'll try to combine. The first part was, are you beginning to see commodities ease off, and what does it mean for future pricing? And the second one, any comments around inflation and how it's being managed?
On the easing of commodity, we see some go. I mean, we all have seen the oil going starting to go down. We see a bit of relaxing on some things. I think the feature that we see, and we discussed a minute ago, I think the feature that that we see and we keep seeing is extreme volatility. I mean, I'm not sure that gas 2 days ago and gas yesterday after the explosion is the same. So we will keep seeing volatility, and we'll keep seeing some form of volatility linked to also the geopolitical uncertainties and some of the climate events. Which brings me to what I said earlier on the way you manage inflation. You manage it by playing on your full keyboard. I mean, there is not one way of managing inflation. You manage it by trying to be better every time at productivity. You increase your productivity levels. And the more you look, the more you find. You, by the way, keep investing behind your brand because differentiation of your brand justifies their premium. So you don't run away from the market. You don't run away from innovation. You actually focus on making your brands and products even more relevant. And then you play on the entire price of formats, individual SKUs, and all the rest of it. So.
I think with that, we've come to the end of the session. Antoine, thank you very much for being here. And to the audience, thank you very much for participating. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.